Today is Friday, the 6th of January, 2017, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, why did Russia apparently want Donald Trump to win the U.S. presidential election?
Well, they were convinced that Hillary Clinton had regime change in Russia as one of her main objectives.
And you'll hear from the woman who runs the Russia-Eurasia Department at Harvard University all about that. What is supposed to be a great new movie is opening in the United States, throughout the United States, later on today. And you'll hear all about that movie, all on International Edition today. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, who has dismissed the idea from the U.S. intelligence community that Russia hacked into the recent presidential election process, is scheduled to be receiving a full briefing today from the leaders of the intelligence community. In an unprecedented move for a president-elect, Trump has been highly critical of the intelligence community, although on Thursday he did soften his tone somewhat with a tweet that said he was a big fan of U.S. intelligence. On Thursday, America's top spies testified the evidence is firm that Russia did interfere with the November presidential election, but they say there's no way to tell if it helped Trump win. National Intelligence Director James Clapper told the Senate Armed Services Committee the Russians have a long history of interfering in elections, theirs and other people's. Clapper told the senators that Russia undertook a multifaceted campaign that included not just hacking and leaking Democratic Party emails, but also classical propaganda, misinformation, and fake news. The question we're asking today is where all of this leaves what remains of the U.S.-Russia relationship. Joining us is Alexandra Vakru, Executive Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University. Dr. Vakru, thanks so much for being with us. Donald Trump's apparent stance on Russia has obviously, you know, been making headlines. Does whatever reaction Russia has had to that stance give any hint at all of what lies ahead as far as that relationship is concerned?
I wouldn't say that they've been reacting to his pronouncement or his tweets. I was in Moscow in December and met with quite a few Russians who were happy that he had won and who were quite optimistic about what was likely to happen to U.S.-Russia relations in the future. I'm not sure that that's based really on what they know about Trump's policy. I think it's more about the fact that they were extremely concerned about a Clinton win and what that might mean for U.S.-Russia relations.
What did they think that might mean as opposed to whatever glee there might have been about the Trump win?
Well, they were convinced that Hillary Clinton had regime change in Russia as one of her main objectives. The Russian people took to the streets after some debatable elections in 2011, and those protests on the street continued through 2012 and 2013. And many of the people in Putin's administration were convinced that Clinton was behind them as Secretary of State. When you add to that the protests that broke out in Ukraine and that led to Yanukovych's removal in February 2014, you get a pattern that the Russians saw of Hillary Clinton basically fomenting regime change and protest abroad. So they believed that if she came back to power as president, she would be very keen on trying to remove Putin. As a result, they were fomenting a kind of propaganda campaign in the Russian media against her, sort of frightening people that if she came to the presidency, that there would be war between Russia and the United States. And even people that I met in some of the Russian provinces in December were saying it's so good that she didn't win because we were sure there was going to be a war.
Well, what do you think Russia hopes will happen with its relationship with the United States under a Trump administration?
Well, that's quite interesting because, of course, they have no more idea than we do about what Trump's likely Russia policy is going to be. They are taking heart by the fact that Rex Tillerson has been made Secretary of State. He has an ongoing positive relationship with Russia and with Putin as the former head of Exxon. And I think they believe that Trump is the kind of person who's willing to put the past aside and come up with a new way of dealing with Russia and with the bilateral relationship. And given, as you said in your introduction, that the relationship has never been so bad, at this point they believe that it can only improve.
So why go through, if true, from the U.S. intelligence apparatus, why go through with a hacking situation if that's what they would like to see?
Well, they weren't sure that Trump would win. They wanted to tip the scales in his favor.
Even with the hacking situation, do you ever expect to see any form of detente entering the picture here, especially with that intelligence stance on hacking taken into account?
I don't think that the intelligence stance on hacking is going to make much of a difference, unfortunately. I'm not sure what's going on in that briefing today between the heads of the intelligence agencies and Trump, but I would be very surprised if he would change his position. And I think that even if he's willing to acknowledge that the Russians did hack into the DNC and leak the emails, possibly through WikiLeaks, I don't think that that's going to change his conviction that they should now go back to Putin and see how we can improve U.S.-Russia relations. The question is, if he's willing to make a deal, and that's what the Russians are hoping, what is that deal going to look like? What is it that the U.S. would want to get that would be worth making some of the significant concessions that Moscow would undoubtedly like us to make?
Do you think that Trump's stance on Russia has grown out of the hope of making a deal and nothing more?
I don't know that Trump has been thinking in terms of why we would want to do a deal. He hasn't really talked about, for example, nuclear arms negotiations or arms control, which is one area in which negotiations and deals are quite common. I think that his objective is more to establish positive relationships with Russia. And the way you do that is you let bygones be bygones, as it were, or maybe they're not even that important, and you move on and kind of establish a personal relationship with the Russian president and take it from there. Now, what I think we're likely to see is there'll be an initial meeting between Trump and Putin, and it will go very well. There won't be very much substance, but they'll establish some kind of personal rapport. But the real question is going to come, what happens later when Putin does something to test Trump, which he inevitably will, and Trump sees that as possibly a betrayal or possibly an implication that he's not a strong leader, and then chooses to react with tweets or with something more serious. That's what we're really concerned about.
Dr. Alexandra Vakhru, Executive Director of the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard University, thank you so much for your contribution today.
Happy to do it.
Among the top stories in the world today, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump will receive a full briefing Friday from the leaders of the intelligence community. Russia is beginning a drawdown of its military resources in Syria. Police in the Bangladesh capital say they have shot dead the prime suspect in last year's brutal attack on a cafe in Dhaka. Japan has temporarily recalled its ambassador to South Korea because of a comfort woman statue installed in front of the Japanese consulate in the South Korean city of Busan. And soldiers in Ivory Coast launched mutinies in three cities on Friday in a bid for higher pay. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Indian scientists say that the Earth's protective magnetosphere cracked momentarily during a severe solar storm back on June 22, 2015. The storm was the result of plasma blasts from the sun's outer atmosphere, or corona, a few days earlier. The magnetosphere is an area of space that surrounds Earth and helps prevent most of the highly charged solar particles from hitting the surface. The scientists found that the burst of high energy from the storm smacked into the magnetosphere at a speed of about 2.5 million kilometers per hour. The researchers observed the blast of solar energy with a device that detects and monitors cosmic rays. Information from their observations were used to perform numerical simulations, which indicated the temporary crack in the magnetosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman in Washington, and joining me, as always, is Andrew Palshesky. And we have a lot to talk about, a lot of things happening, especially with the inauguration of the new president coming and how he's using social media and all kinds of stuff. And we, I understand, continue our conversation with fake news?
Yes, we're talking about two of our favorite topics today. The first, of course, fake news, which I think is has been our favorite topic for the past couple months that we've been talking about just about every Friday. And this is an interesting story that just happened this week. It actually has a bit of a Washington connection. The Washington Post reported earlier this week that the electrical grid in the city of Burlington, Vermont, had potentially been breached by Russian hackers, and this was widely reported, widely disseminated on social media, and they actually backtracked after they reported that, saying that it wasn't breached, but there was suspected breach by Russians. Well, it turns out it was all a computer that had visited a potentially malicious website. No breach, no evidence of hacking. It was just this website that had been visited. And what happened was that an official heard this news and gave information that was false. And that false information spread like wildfire on social media. And this story, I think, highlights, even though we talk about the power of social media to spread fake news, highlights, too, that it all starts somewhere. This news starts with a person. And even the fake news that we see on social media is written by somebody. And so that's something to keep in mind, that while we talk about the social media and how they can spread fake news and spread misinformation, it all does come from somewhere. In this case, it was unintentional, but a lot of times it is very much intentional.
And, you know, that's almost understandable. In fact, that is understandable, the way social media works right now. And I think what I've been railing against anyway are the other kind, when they either thought up by a government, thought up by a group, or thought out by, as our president-elect said, somebody who weighs 400 pounds sitting on the side of a bed.
You know? That's the trouble. I mean, that's a lot of what we're seeing now, is that kind of fabricated news. But it does happen from time to time in the real world, and it is accidental. It's not malicious. It's someone mishears something. But it just speaks to how fragile information can be and how important it is to have good, credible information when you're putting news out there.
And, well, we were speaking about the... the fake news, but you're also talking about the president-elect and his use of Twitter.
Yes, other favorite news topic that we talked about.
That's under a lot of, I don't want to say so much criticism as it is a lot of people looking very closely at it.
Yeah, I mean, you had today Donald Trump talking about Mexico is going to reimburse the U.S. after they pay for the wall. He tweeted about Arnold Schwarzenegger now hosting Celebrity Apprentice. And maybe perhaps trying to distract from his comments about the wall. But we've seen more serious situations where he's talked about companies. He's gone after GM. He's gone after Boeing, Lockheed Martin, others, Toyota. And so this is fascinating. There are actually companies that are on the West Coast of the United States, 3 hours behind us on the East Coast. They're having people that are waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning Pacific time on the West Coast, because that's when Donald Trump starts tweeting. It's 6 a.m. Eastern time in New York. So they're actually having people wake up to monitor so they can do damage control if he tweets about their company. And our colleague Steve Miller, we were talking with him earlier, and he pointed out that there's an app now called Trigger where you can put in which stocks you have in your portfolio. It will send you a personalized alert if Donald Trump tweets anything that could affect your stock portfolio.
Yeah, and it's a big business story. Can we bring in Jill Malandrino here?
I am here.
Okay, Jill, have you been listening to what we've been talking about?
Yes, and it's interesting. That's part of what I wanted to talk in regards to the markets as well, because Trump's policies, they remain very uncertain, and there are the potential effects of the rising dollar and oil, and I think that is going to impact earnings season. But another thing that analysts and traders did not anticipate was going to be the impact of what he says via social media. We have seen stocks like Lockheed Martin and Boeing, a lot of names in the defensive sector that have moved off of what he puts out there on Twitter, and I think it's fascinating to watch that.
Well, again, Toyota stocks went right down today when he just criticize the company for planning to open a factory in Mexico, right?
Right. Well, it's interesting because Toyota is a Japanese company, even though the stock is listed on the New York Stock Exchange. It's still a Japanese company. I also find it kind of counterintuitive where he campaigned on deregulation and making it more friendly for companies to conduct business. That's why we've seen such a tremendous run in financial and tech stocks and so forth. So when he comes out and he's either openly praising a company like Ford, who is canceling their Mexico factory and building one in Detroit, or if he's criticizing Japan for building a factory in Mexico, that sounds nothing like deregulation to me. I can't recall, at least in my lifetime and based on the research that I've done, where a president-elect at that has been so vocal in terms of what companies can and cannot do. And that sets a pretty scary precedent.
That it does. Let us turn now to some reports that came out today as the Obama administration is winding down.
Yeah, well, we had the key monthly employment situation report, which came mostly in line with expectations, and this was the last one of President Obama's administration, so let's take a look at some numbers here. Since Obama took office in 2009, the economy has added over 11 million jobs. That's a tremendous improvement since U.S. unemployment reached its peak of 10% in October 2009. In fact, this month marks the 75th consecutive month of job gains in the U.S. That said, gains in actual wage growth have lagged, and the conversation is now shifting to skills that currently fit the labor market. And I think that's a conversation that we're going to have for years to come, especially as we look at education in this country and our younger generations being taught what they're going to need based on the economy that we're going to have just, let's say, in the next 5 to 10 years.
Wow. I mean, we can expect, I take it, that the market is expecting huge changes with a new administration. Is that
correct? Absolutely. Yeah, I think that we will see some volatility, certainly the first 100 days of Trump's administration, because he did campaign on heavy rhetoric. And there's a big difference between putting theory into practice, and we're starting to even see a little bit now where this morning he's tweeting out, oh, I didn't mean that Mexico's paying for the wall. They're going to pay for it at some point later, or as you mentioned before, commenting on company business practices. So I think the first 100 days, we will see some volatility come back into the market, but right now the trend seems to suggest that we're going to stay with the upward momentum, but I think we should expect a little bit of volatility around in the next quarter or two between that, and then we have earnings season kicking off next week with the big banks on Friday.
And we'll talk to you next Friday about that. That's Jill Malandrino joining us live from New York, Andrew Palczewski here in the studio in Washington, D.C., and this is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
We continue on VOA's International Edition. Talk about movies, Hidden Figures, the Hollywood version of a true story of three black women who in 1962 helped NASA launch pioneer astronaut John Glenn into orbit. Katherine G. Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, and Mary Jackson broke the gender and race ceiling working as NASA mathematicians, computer experts, and engineers during the Jim Crow era in the United States. More from VOA's Penelope Pulu.
You know what we're doing here? We're putting a human on top of a missile, shooting them into space, and it's never been done before.
In the early 1960s, the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union is in full force. Trailing the Soviets, NASA prepares for the first manned orbital mission.
It's crunch time. In 14 days, astronauts will be here for training. Everything we do is going to matter to their wives, to their children. I believe it's going to matter to the whole damn country.
My gals are ready. We can do the work.
During that crucial time, three African-American women play a pivotal role in helping to compute NASA's orbit trajectories. Oscar winner Octavia Spencer interprets Dorothy Vaughan, NASA's first African-American manager of the agency's segregated West Area Computing Unit. Spencer, who has already garnered award nominations for her role, spoke to VOA about the significance of this untold story.
There were ceilings broken at NASA, but the fact that the world didn't know who they are lets us know that we still have work yet to do.
I need a mathematician that can look beyond the numbers. Math that doesn't yet exist. Before the Russians plant a flag on the damn moon.
Katherine Johnson was that mathematician and the central figure in the story. Taraji Henson interprets Johnson, a mother of three, and a modest genius with one goal in mind, solve the problem. Her unfaltering computations kept John Glenn safe as he orbits the Earth. Kevin Costner plays her manager. He spoke to VOA about his role.
It's important for all of us to break those walls down, to drop the barriers. And I had a lot of pride in being able to do that in the movie.
If you were a white male, would you wish to be an engineer?
I wouldn't have to. I'd already be one.
Janelle Monáe, who plays Mary Jackson, a feisty mother of two and the first African-American woman to become an engineer, has this message for young girls, especially minority girls, today.
You can be mathematicians, scientists, engineers. You can be in technology. You can change the world. These women did it, and they went through a lot of obstacles. You belong, and genius has no color or gender. Brilliance has no color or gender. And as long as you continue to just do the work, you'll end up on top, always.
Catherine, we all gonna end up unemployed riding around in this pile of junk.
You're welcome to walk the 16, man.
All sit in the back of the bus.
Hidden Figures has received praise for its ensemble cast. Its uplifting message reached all the way to the International Space Station, where U.S. astronaut Peggy Whitson, the female record holder for most time in space, sent this message via satellite during the Hidden Figures premiere.
It is my hope that the Mars generation, the vibrant, innovative workforce of our future, finds inspiration as I have in these pioneering women. Enjoy the film, and thank you from all of us, 250 miles above the Earth, on board the International Space Station.
Hidden Figures is expected to be one of the most popular films of the season. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Off. Now that's on my list for this weekend to go see that movie. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook at VOA Now. Follow us on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. Thanks for being with us. Our thanks to director Diane Gao, engineer Pete Hunley, and I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the recent signing of a political compromise agreement by the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, and opposition party leaders. By paving the way for peaceful democratic elections in 2017, this agreement marks an important and historic step for the DRC and the region of Central Africa. The United States commends the willingness of President Joseph Kabila and opposition leaders to compromise on key issues, thereby laying the groundwork for the country's first democratic transfer of power. Under the Constitution, President Kabila should have left office on December 20th, at the end of his second and final mandate. A crisis ensued when he failed to organize elections and stepped down. Under the terms of the deal, President Kabila agreed not to seek a third term or change the Constitution, but will remain in office until the installation of his successor, following elections which will be held by the end of December 2017. An oversight council responsible for overseeing implementation of the agreement will be established and headed by opposition leader Etienne Tshisekedi, and a prime minister will be named from among the opposition Rassemblement coalition. The United States also commends the tireless mediating role played by the DRC's Conference of Catholic Bishops, leading to this agreement. Blessed with natural resources but burdened with corruption and political instability, the Democratic Republic of Congo has never witnessed a democratic transfer of power since it gained independence from Belgium in 1960. 2 decades ago, the country fought some of the deadliest conflicts in modern African history. Wars in the late 1990s and early 2000s dragged in forces from at least 6 African countries and left more than 3 million dead. The east of the country remains a battleground for armed conflict between rival militias. This political agreement provides an opportunity to take the DRC in a new and peaceful direction. The United States, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner, encourages the DRC government and opposition leaders to continue their cooperation as they work to implement this agreement and preserve the progress achieved on behalf of the Congolese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.